You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to this podcast on myelodysplastic syndrome, or MDS, hosted by Med Learning Group. This podcast is one in a series of two geared towards hematologists and other caregivers who treat this condition. In this podcast, Dr. Daniel D'Angelo will discuss the identification and diagnosis of MDS. My name is Chris, and I'll be the host of today's podcast. So I'd like to welcome Dr. D'Angelo, who is joining us today. Dr. D'Angelo is chief of the Division of Leukemia at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and he's also a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. He has researched and spoken at length about myelodysplastic syndrome and has been involved with many educational programs on MDS and other hematologic conditions for several years. Thank you for being here with us today, Dr. D'Angelo.
Thank you, Chris. I'm so happy to be with you today.
So let's start with a little bit of background in the area of MDS. Talk about the scope of this problem in the United States. What is it and how does it arise?
So I like to think about myelodysplastic syndrome as a disease of older folks or aging. That's not exactly true because younger patients can get myelodysplastic syndrome. There's many varieties. The median age is somewhere between 68 and 70, and it's probably the most common disease that a patient has never heard of, so to speak. It is a form of bone marrow failure. And that's probably not fair. The bone marrow is trying to make the white cells, red cells, and platelets, but just not able to. So these are patients typically as they get older who have low blood counts, somewhere around 30 to 40,000 cases in the United States are diagnosed each year. That's a rough number because we don't keep specific numbers of that. The SEER database is an approximation of that. MDS is a clonal disorder. That is, there's a either a cytogenetic or a molecular mutation that characterizes the disease. And there may be a way of, as a precursor, diagnosing this before patients develop cytopenias. But the diagnosis of myelodysplastic syndrome really is these low blood counts, typically in older patients, that is heralded by very specific bone marrow changes that we'll get to later.
So there's overlap between MDS and other hematologic conditions. How do you distinguish MDS from these conditions, such as clonal cytopenia of unknown significance or acute myeloid leukemia?
So the World Health Organization has repetitively updated, and the most recent is in 2022, and we'll go through that a little bit later. But basically, there's some very clear ways of making a diagnosis. And so you can think about a diagnosis, as I said in my prior answer, that is, you know, an older person with low blood counts, particularly with a macrocytic anemia, those are some heralded features that are characteristic of patients with myelodysplastic syndrome. But in order to make a diagnosis of myelodysplasia, three things need to happen. One, the patient has to have dysplasia. And the way I explain it to the patient, it's shape, plastic shape, dysplastic, abnormal shape. So there's very characteristically abnormal shapes of either white cells, red cells, or platelet-making cells, the megakaryocytes, that are very characteristic in a bone marrow aspirate, and they have to have 10% or more of any one of those lineages. So that's one. Two, an increase in the number of these blasts or immature cells. Normal is somewhere between 1 and 4%, or very characteristic cytogenetic abnormalities. So one of those three things will make a diagnosis of myelodysplastic syndrome. And if a patient doesn't have that, but has low blood counts and a clonal marker, some mutation or cytogenetic abnormality, well, then that's a diagnosis of CCUS, which is often a precursor. Patients with clonal cytopenias have a risk of developing myelodysplastic syndrome, but they haven't met one of those three characteristics that I mentioned. And then acute leukemia is just a numbers game. Depending upon the subtype of leukemia, if you have 20% or more blasts, and there are some mutations that you need 10% or more, again, just a numbers game, then you make the diagnosis of acute myeloid leukemia.
So you alluded briefly to the risk of developing MDS. What are some of the precursor conditions and what patients have a higher risk of developing MDS eventually?
So the biggest risk is age, as I alluded to. So the older one gets, the more likely that a patient's going to develop these characteristic findings. But things that we do as oncologists to patients, that is chemotherapy, prior chemotherapy. And there's some chemotherapies that place patients at a higher risk. They cause bone marrow damage. And so these are typically chemotherapies that are used in a variety of diseases, but they're called alkylating agents, and they can cause DNA damage. And that DNA damage in time, usually with a median of around 5 to 7 years after exposure, can cause myelodysplastic syndromes. The other cause would be radiation therapy. Now, we are exposed to radiation just in the environment, some people in their work job, x-rays, but patients with certain types of malignancies are going to get radiotherapy to different parts. And depending on how much radiation and what that exposure is also precludes one to an increased risk. Exposure workplace, benzene exposure. Most people are not exposed to benzene anymore, but that would be in the petroleum industry. Tobacco has a very slight increase. We think about lung cancer, bladder cancer, but there's a slight increase in the risk of marrow failure. So again, the most common risks are, in addition to aging, the exposure to certain types of chemotherapeutics and radiation.
So you also alluded to the World Health Organization. As far as MDS classification systems, I know there's a couple out there. What are they and how do they differ from each other?
So that's a great question. The World Health Organization has been the governing body for probably 2.5 decades, but there's been a split. So the World Health Organization every few years updates their criteria for making a diagnosis of myelodysplastic syndrome. And differentiating myelodysplastic syndrome from acute leukemia, as well as subclassifying myelodysplastic syndrome into different risk groups based on what you see under the microscope. And many of the pathologists and physicians that were part of the last update in 2016, the WHO 2016 split, and formed the International Consensus Classification, or ICC. So now there's two. There's the World Health Organization 2022, and then there's the ICC, or International Consensus Classification, that was also came out in 2022. And although they're very similar, there's some distinctions. So historically, 20% of these immature cells we call blasts was the line in the sand between myelodysplastic syndrome and acute myeloid leukemia. The ICC has defined many of these subtypes now as 10% or more to be myelodysplastic syndrome / AML. So they've moved the line in the sand a little to the left for many, not all, but many subclasses of MDS to be characterized as AML. There's all sorts of regulatory issues and clinical trial issues that's going to raise. But our pathologists now are listing a diagnosis, both the WHO 2022 as well as the ICC, and there's been some confusion over the last few years. By and large, most patients have very similar criteria for establishing a diagnosis, with the exceptions that I mentioned, that is this dividing line in some subclasses of 10% or more.
So you talked about the classification, the World Health Organization and the other governing bodies as well. So classification is often used for clinical trials and setting up cohorts and that. How is an actual diagnosis of MDS actually established? I'm assuming it's a combination of things, lab tests, bone marrow biopsy, et cetera, et cetera. What do you need to confirm the presence of MDS?
You're absolutely right, Chris. You know, in order to make a diagnosis, you really need a bone marrow examination. Now, some folks will say if you have low blood counts in the right patient population and you have a molecular, that is a mutation assessment, these next generation sequencing, which you can get off the blood and the bone marrow, and they're the same, that may be enough. But I really think you need a bone marrow examination in order to quantify these blast cells, because they're not always in the peripheral blood. So at least here in my institution and the way I practice, we always get a bone marrow examination. And so that bone marrow is really looking at the morphology of the marrow. There's two aspects of a bone marrow examination. There's the bone marrow aspirate, which is a liquid phase, and then there's the biopsy. The diagnosis of myelodysplastic syndrome is solely based on the bone marrow aspirate, looking at the morphology. And you're looking for dysplasia, these abnormally shaped cells of 10% or more, within the white blood cell, red blood cell, or megakaryocytes, the precursors of platelets. So there needs to be 10% or more dysplasia within any one of those lineages. And then you're actually counting blast cells. Now, you and I both have blast cells, and the average blast for a patient without a bone marrow disorder is about 2% with a range of 1 to 4. But if you have 5% or more, that's abnormal, and that would put you into the increased blast. And that's another criteria, not only for diagnosis, but also for classification, which we'll get to later. And then cytogenetics and molecular are very important in terms of prognosis. There are some cytogenetic abnormalities that are only seen in patients with myelodysplastic syndrome. So there are MDS-defining lesions, but others are not. But nevertheless, cytogenetics and molecular are very important for establishing the diagnosis and then for prognosis.
So let's finish up this podcast with just a few final thoughts. So we'll be getting to treatment in our second podcast, but how do you feel this disease state has changed over, say, the past decade? Is it now easier to identify based on the newer classification? Have we learned more about the genetic components? Is treatment and prognosis getting better? What are your thoughts?
Well, MDS has evolved over the last few years. I think the ability to diagnose it is roughly the same. That really hasn't changed. It's really back to the old microscope of looking at, bone marrow aspirates. So that's about the same. It's more complicated now in terms of classification. There's lots of different classification systems that have evolved over the years. But what they've done now is they've included cytogenetics, and the original classifications included a few cytogenetic abnormalities, but with time we've now established and have noted a lot more cytogenetic abnormalities, so that's very important. And then molecular subclassification, which was not present 10 years ago, maybe even 5 years ago in some of the local labs, it's been part of the academic milieu for at least a decade, and now it's standard. You can absolutely not prognosticate a patient without a molecular classification. So, what was happening before was just a bone marrow examination. Now it's bone marrow examination, cytogenetics, and very important molecular in order to classify every single patient with myelodysplastic syndrome in terms of putting them into their subgroups and establishing treatment modalities. So that's what's changed. The complexity of the disease has changed, not necessarily the ability to diagnose MDS versus other myeloid disorders.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. D'Angelo. This has been an excellent discussion of the background of MDS and how it's identified and differentiated from other conditions in hematology practice. But that's it for now. Once again, thank you, Dr. D'Angelo, for joining us. And thanks to all of our listeners for joining as well. As a reminder, this is the first in a series of 2 podcasts on MDS. So I invite you to listen to our second podcast, in which we'll discuss treatment options in further detail. Additionally, MedLearning Group offers many types of CME programs across a variety of disease states, including several hematology topics. I invite you to explore these on our website, medlearninggroup.com. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I would also like to give a special thank you to our grant supporter, Bristol-Myers Squibb, who provided an unrestricted grant for this educational activity. Thank you very much and have a great day.